Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and welcome to episode 64 of Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest is Belinda Bauer, whose Rubbernecker, which was the winner of the 2014 Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year, has just been published in North America by Grove Atlantic. Naturally, it was after I turned off the recorder and we were just chatting that Belinda provided a perfect, succinct description of her book. So for this episode, I'm going to begin at the very end, and then we'll go back to the beginning. Make sense? Well, I hope that it will. Here's Belinda's description of Rubbernecker.
Rubbernecker is about a medical student who suspects that the body he's dissecting in anatomy class might be a murder victim, and he has to try to retro-engineer the crime and solve it before he finishes cutting up the evidence.
In the rest of the interview, Belinda talks about Patrick Fort, the medical student at the heart of the book who has Asperger's syndrome, and the novel's other two unreliable narrators, as well as the personal money-back guarantee that Belinda offered people she encountered in bookshops that they would enjoy Rubbernecker. Here again is Belinda Bauer. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest today is Belinda Bauer, whose Rubbernecker is an award-winning book in Great Britain and has just been released in the United States, I believe, on August 4th. Welcome, Belinda.
Thank you so much.
I read on your website that you said that the original idea for Rubbernecker came to you when you dreamt you were dead. And part of your research was actually attending dissections. And that didn't give you bad dreams?
No, I have bad dreams every night. If I don't have bad dreams, I'm not feeling like a creative person. And I don't recall the last time I had a good dream. And so that's just part of the course for me. But the one I had that night was a doozy.
I can imagine. And we should say that, we should explain that Rubbernecker, first of all, Rubbernecker means someone who has got a ghoulish interest in an accident. You know, they're
correct.
The one.
Those people on the freeway who slow down so they can watch somebody crash on the other side.
Right. And all the imaginings that sort of spin from that. And that actually is in very early in your book. One of your protagonists does look at an accident, starts to think about the results of that accident right then, and it's funny that the course of the book brings him in contact with that case again.
That's correct. Yeah.
But I'm just, you know, I am curious that you had to go to such great lengths to you said that you went. You watched a lot of dissections on through the computer, but you felt you had to go to a medical school and actually watch the procedures of dissecting a cadaver.
Absolutely. I did feel that. I was a journalist for several years, and I know that there's only so much research you can do through a third person, and I had been told, my father was a dentist and had done dissections at university. One of my neighbours was a doctor and had done dissections at university. And so I had an awful lot of input and expert opinion and stuff like that. But the one thing they told me about that I really needed to go for was the smell. They all told me about the smell. They couldn't get rid of it. The whole 7 years at university, they all stank of it, you know. And I just really felt as though I had to go there and see for myself. And, of course, the smell was very interesting to describe in the book. But to be honest, whenever you do that kind of research, you always get more than you ever imagined you would get from going there in person and seeing it with your own eyes and speaking to people yourself. You know, without going to the dissection room and watching dissections for myself, I don't think Rubbernecker would have been half the book that it is, because it had such an impact on me. And I'm a very squeamish person, so I was dreading going, but I'm so pleased that I did.
Well, I mean, it is a doozy, and the descriptions of the dissection room are really they're both quotidian and quite chilling. You know, it's this, I found it was a contrast between this is just a work day for the students and the people that are attending these dissections, and yet it's also, these are people who were once alive and are now dead and are about to be minced so the students can learn.
Well, that's right, and I think that everybody who's in that sort of, who does that kind of work, in whatever the context, has to strike a balance between, you know, thinking of the cadaver as a former person and thinking of it as an exercise in dissection or embalming or whatever it is they need to do to it. And otherwise, I mean, people would be breaking down the whole time and unable to touch the body and stuff like that. So everybody finds a way to cope. And I think that particularly the medical students, there's this kind of dark humour that they're employing all the time to get through the day and to make it okay for themselves to actually cut up dead bodies.
Well, look, in Rubbernecker, it doesn't just have one unreliable narrator. It has three. Your chief protagonist, Patrick Fort, has Asperger's syndrome. And there's a coma patient, Samuel Gallen, who is trying to emerge, and we get to listen to his thoughts. And Tracy Evans, who's a sort of a feckless nurse who thinks she's living in a romance novel. And I'm wondering where these three characters came from.
Well, I've had some flack from people about Tracy Evans, who, as you said, completely feckless and selfish and a little bit less caring than you'd like a nurse to be. But funnily enough, she was the only character in the book that I actually based on somebody I knew. So whenever somebody says to me, oh, you've been terribly unfair to nurses, I can always say that to them, and I do it with a clear conscience. And I've had loads of people come up to me having read the book and said, I'm a nurse, and oh, there's always girls like that in the wards, which is quite sobering. And really, it was one of the reasons I wanted to write. I've been thinking for a long time about writing a novel from the point of view of somebody who's in a hospital bed, and that sense of vulnerability that you get when you're ill, you're without your own clothes, you're at the mercy of doctors, and you're in a room full of strangers. It's a horrible place to be, a hospital. And so, and it came to fruition in Rubbernecker. As for the other two characters, Sam, who's emerging from a coma during the course of the book, I created him to suit my own needs, as I did with Patrick, who's the protagonist of Rubbernecker. And he's an 18-year-old student who has Asperger's syndrome and wants to understand what happens after you die. And that's why he signed up to do anatomy at university. Patrick was such an interesting character for me to create. I needed somebody who wouldn't share the information that he had, which is why I decided to make him a person who had Asperger's syndrome, because what it does for the character, it means that he's not only unwilling or unable to share, but he really doesn't understand the information that comes into his possession, and nor does he understand that the danger he may be in as he collects this information over the course of the book.
But to me, at least, Rubbernecker calls into question sort of what is normal and who exactly is living within societal norms. You know, Patrick has this processing difficulty, but as I read the book, he understands the difference between right and wrong, and he's actually incapable of telling an untruth. And a lot of the tension seems to come from that disconnect. Patrick.
Yeah, I mean, I think every person who suffers from Asperger's syndrome is at a different point on the autism spectrum. So, it's a difficult thing to kind of generalize about, but in another way, it makes it easy to pick out one person and say, this is their experience of the world. And that that truthfulness is something which I think springs from the fact that it's quite difficult for them to evaluate the consequences of their own behavior on other people. And so what would be the point of telling a lie if you can't imagine that somebody would be offended or might arrest you or something like that? If they can't understand the consequences of their own actions and empathize with the emotions of an opposite number, then where would be the use in telling a lie? And so Patrick is somebody who goes through life calling it like it is, which makes him an attractive person, I think, and an interesting character to use to explore a possible crime, because everything about crime is about covering up, lying, hiding the facts and keeping secrets, and that is the diametric opposition of what Patrick Fort is.
But it also to me was the idea of intelligence. Patrick is obviously quite smart, but as I said, he processes information differently, and to a certain extent, he can't contextualize things.
Yeah, he has no emotional intelligence as such.
So he has no emotion, but it makes those who interact with him think he's stupid or crazy. And
that's right, yeah.
And a lot of his frustrations seem to come from that. He feels he's discovered that the cadaver on which he and his team is working has been murdered. And he can't convince anybody that what he's saying is true. And I think much of it is because he's on the autism spectrum.
Well, absolutely. I think there's a very little propensity for somebody on that spectrum to share their suspicions. Patrick, for a long time in the book, really goes it alone, which I think, again, is something which I was attracted to when I created his character. And when he does want to share with people, he goes about it in the wrong way, or in a way which casts suspicion on himself, or confuses them, or makes them think he's joking. So because he lacks that kind of emotional intelligence and empathy with people, explaining what he thinks he may have found in the dissection room is very difficult for Patrick, which, of course, is very good for me.
And, of course, the irony is, you know, you said people think he's joking, and Patrick is really struggles with the concept of humor.
Yes.
Which,
I mean, what I like about the book and when I was writing it, and what I think many people have been attracted to, is that they find such humor in Patrick. And I took great pains to create Patrick as honestly as I could from my research and experience of Asperger's syndrome. And I really didn't write him as a humorous character, but he became that way naturally. And I was so pleased that people enjoyed his company so much, because it's quite a challenge to create a character who really lacks empathy and yet have the reader empathize with them.
But he's self-aware. I mean, he knows that he lacks, at least my reading of it, is he knows that he lacks these things like empathy and humor. And to that makes, at least to me, it made him very winning. It made him very sympathetic.
I think it makes him sympathetic because it's so sad. If somebody lacks empathy and lacks the capacity for humor and they're not aware of it, then it doesn't matter. But Patrick has understood enough to know that he's different from other people, and that becomes A, very attractive trait in him when he's trying to overcome it, but B, it makes him a sympathetic character when he might not have been because of his own lack of empathy.
Well, it also shines a light on the perspective of unacceptable coping mechanisms. You mentioned that earlier, that the students and the people that work in the dissection theater have to create coping mechanisms. Patrick's are very, very different from his fellow students, and I thought his specific coping mechanisms were very, very interesting, and I guess that came from your research.
Yeah, he has all kinds. of ways that he's got through life. And as far as Patrick's concerned, if a plate with an alphabet on it has helped him when he was 5 years old, it will probably still help him when he's a student at university cutting up cadavers. And so, people on the spectrum quite often resist change in every facet of their lives. And so a lot of these coping mechanisms are very childlike and, again, lend Patrick this sense of innocence, I think, that most 18-year-old boys probably, it would be difficult to actually imbue them with that kind of innocence in the context of a crime novel.
I can tell, you mentioned that you enjoyed writing this book, and I have the feeling that you enjoyed writing this book a great deal.
I loved it. And once I understood where Patrick's head was at every point, I absolutely loved writing him. And when I finished writing him, I was so sad to say goodbye to him. And so I'm always looking out for another way I can revisit Patrick.
It strikes me that the detective who made this sort of his case could very well revisit Patrick, should you ever use him again.
It was kind of nice. The detective is a very stolid, unambitious man who sort of stumbles onto the case that Patrick's been investigating and arrests Patrick on suspicion of murder at one point. But then, just through solid, unadventurous police work, he starts to make progress on the case. And I think he and Patrick make a great combination, even though Patrick's extremely rude to him. So it's an interesting dynamic.
It's an interesting dynamic, but I think, one, you describe him as stolid, but he's also is an investigator. He is a policeman, and
he has no flair.
He has no flair, but he seems to have a great deal of logic, and in that he shares with Patrick. He may not have ambition, but he knows that 2 and 2 does not add up to 5.
Exactly, and I think the two of them together complement each other because Patrick only has he has doggedness, he has information that the policeman is not privy to. And yet, between them, even though the communication between them is woeful, they do manage to get through it together at the end.
They manage to find a common language, and that's of course to Patrick's benefit eventually. But I don't want to introduce any spoilers because the end of this book is just so satisfying on so many different levels. Rubbernecker won and please correct me if I mispronounce any of this, the Theakston Old Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year. Actually, last year. It was written in 2013.
That's correct.
And I'm wondering, why is the U.S. so far behind the curve on this book? Why are we just seeing it in 2015?
I didn't have a publishing deal in the U.S., and I guess it's like, all books have the perfect reader somewhere, and Rubbernecker was just waiting for my perfect U.S. reader, which, Globe Atlantic read it, and they wanted it, and now they've published it, and I'm so thrilled, because it's very frustrating when you write a book that everybody loves. It's as simple as that. I've written other books, and most people have loved them, but some people have hated them, but Rubbernecker is this book that I confidently tell people. I'll walk up to people in bookshops and say, "Do you read crime?" And if they're standing at the crime shelf, and they say yes, I'll say to them, if you read this book of mine, Rubbernecker, and you don't like it, I will give you your money back. That's how confident I am that people love this book, because I don't know anybody who doesn't.
Well, it's funny when the publicist at Grove Atlantic, who sort of knows my taste and I know hers, and she sent it to me in the ARC, and she said, you have to read this book. And then I read it, and I did something I almost never do, but it's to what you just said. I lent it to somebody.
Yeah.
And I usually don't lend ARCs. You're not supposed to. And like Patrick, I do like to follow the rules, but I knew somebody who would absolutely loved this book, and I gave her the ARC. And then I get a lot of books, and I do a number of interviews, and I had written it down. I keep a list, and I had written it down. And then I went back to the list. I said, God, there's a book I know I want to follow up on. I went back to the list, and I called my contact at Grove Atlantic. And then I said, you have to send me another copy, because now this person I lent the ARC to, which I know I'm not supposed to do, and I'm really, really sorry, has... can't find it, or says she can't find it. So they sent me another one, and I reread it very quickly, and I said, oh God, I have to talk to you, because you're absolutely right. This hits on so many notes: procedural, unreliable narrator, three of them, and a satisfactory sort of locked room mystery, in a way.
I mean, jargon that you know more about than I do, Nancy. I mean, I was not brought up in a milieu of crime fiction. I just never read crime fiction before I started to write crime fiction, and I still feel as though I'm feeling my way through it. I understand the words unreliable narrator, but unjust, and everything else is still a mystery to me. And so I decided to just carry on writing in blissful ignorance and hope that what I'm doing is a crime novel, and that I'm achieving what I want to do which is just to tell the best story I can with the best characters I can. And I set it in a crime context, and I hope that it's what people want to read. It just so happens with this book in particular, it's just hit the mark with everybody, and it's such a thrill, and I'm so delighted that it's now being published in the States and Canada, because it's a book that I know that a few people out there who've managed to buy it from the UK or something like that, they champion it to their friends. But, you know, if people can't go into a shop or go on Amazon or buy the book online, you know, how do they spread the word? It's very, very difficult to do that if you can't immediately buy that book. So I'm just so thrilled, because it's a book that's so close to my heart, and I'm not usually this immodest about my own work, to be honest. But, you know, you just get so much great feedback. And when people say, I loved it, I bought it for so-and-so, I bought it for such-and-such, I bought three copies for so-and-so, you know, I just love Patrick, I love everybody in it, then you just start to believe the publicity that's being generated by it. And I'm just so happy that I found a new audience, I hope, in the States.
Well, you know, I think it would resonate in the States. You know, there's a lot of attention paid to autism and Asperger's and other processing difficulties. And I think it's good that there's an interesting character who's relatable, who's on the spectrum.
Well, exactly. You know, here in this country, it gets a lot of comparisons with the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. For obvious reasons, you have a protagonist who's on the autism spectrum. But for me, that's almost where the comparison ends.
Exactly.
I think although I enjoyed The Curious Incident, I thought the lead character in that book was not sympathetic. I didn't warm to him at all. And so for me, when I thought of the plot for Rubbernecker and the characters involved, I wanted to write a character who was on the autistic spectrum, and yet the reader would warm to them. And that was a real challenge, because obviously you create a character who doesn't himself have empathy with other people. It's quite the challenge to make them empathic. But I've had so many people contact me and say, my son is autistic, my son has Asperger's syndrome, this is exactly what it's like. And also they've given the book to their children who have the condition and said to me they loved it too. And I'm just so thrilled by that. It really justifies the entire years, you know, the year's work I put into that book is completely vindicated just by people like that, if nobody else.
And I find it so interesting, something that you said, though, that you sort of didn't set out to be a crime fiction writer, and yet you've written six crime fiction novels, three of which are available in the States. And I should say that Speaking of Mysteries does have an international audience, although most of it is in North America. So if you didn't sort of come up in that, in the genre, where did you find yourself moving into this, into crime fiction? If you didn't read a lot of crime fiction, who were your influencers?
Well, I didn't read any crime fiction, and so I came into it without any influences in the context of crime fiction being marketed as such. It was only after I became a crime fiction writer that I realized that I'd read a lot of crime fiction, but it wasn't labeled crime fiction. And when you think about it, we all read crime fiction throughout our lives, because it's just that nowadays crime fiction sells so well that publishers will try to market a book as such. But, for instance, To Kill a Mockingbird is a courtroom drama.
Mm-hmm.
If Harper Lee were writing now, that would probably be packaged and sold as a crime novel, and would work beautifully as such. And so when I started to re-examine my lifetime of reading, I realized that actually I knew enough about the genre of crime fiction to write it properly. And but when I was a kid, my hero was Stephen King. And, you know, I think probably of all the influences on my writing, Stephen King had the most influence, because, you know, I read him at a very pivotal time in my life, in my early teens, and a lot of his protagonists were very young. They were small children, I mean, from 5 or 6 years old upwards. And a lot of my protagonists are the same. I love to write through the eyes of a child. In fact, Rubbernackle was virtually the first book I wrote that was, had a completely adult cast, if you will.
Although Patrick is sort of an honorary child.
Exactly. He's an honorary child. He has adult emotions, but he still has plenty of childlike emotions still left in him. I owe a great debt to Stephen King, I think. I don't think I would have written my first crime novel, Blacklands, the way I did if I hadn't read Salem's Lot, for instance. And I think it's interesting that Stephen King is now publishing in the crime fiction genre. In fact, I'm on a short list for the Gold Dagger for Crime Novel of the Year this year with Stephen King. So it's just an amazing genre, which I think is starting to suck in writers from other genres because they realize it's such a rich genre. You can do anything in it. You can absolutely write any story you want, because almost any story that's ever been written in fiction has some crime element to it. My dream, Nancy, I have to tell you right now, is that Stephen King comes to the award ceremony and I can meet him. There you are. I've let it out of the bag. I'm so excited.
I can't think of anyone who can capture suspense the way Stephen King can, whether it's a mystery or horror. I think he defies genre in some of the same ways that you defy genre as well.
Well, you know, I always thought Stephen King was just a superb writer, and so it was such a joy to me. It was almost like one of my children succeeding when he finally started to get the recognition he deserves as a great writer. You know, it took a long, long time for him to transcend that genre, which is so unfair. And I think those books still stand up today. I mean, books like The Shining and Salem's Lot are just, they're just wonderful, wonderful books, and I have such admiration for him. And I never dreamed for one moment that I would ever share a shortlist with him, but wow, that's made my year.
I mean, it really brings home the saying, it's an honor just to be nominated.
You know what? You hear people say that all the time. You think, God, what a load of rubbish that is. And then something like that just happened to me. I was like, oh, I'm so starry-eyed about it.
to be on the same list as Stephen
Mentioned
King.
Mentioned in the same breath, I think, is the phrase I'm looking for.
But you bring up an interesting point, and of course I talk to crime fiction writers exclusively for this podcast, and we talk a lot about genre and being placed in, you know, on the shelf. I mean, people like Nick Harkaway have said, well, you know, it's an organizing principle. I believe it was Sophie Hanna said, you know, if I want to read a particular kind of book, it's nice to have that designation. If I want to read horror, if I want to read poetry, you know, if it was all just lumped together, it would be harder to find something. The problem is when genre is spoken of in any sort of disparaging terms, because certainly, you know, you mentioned Stephen King was probably one of the greatest living writers today.
Absolutely right. I mean, I think what Sophie says is correct, but I think it's equally correct to say that, you know, sometimes you don't know what it is you want to read until you read it. And I would hate people to miss out on truly great books just because there was this kind of snobbery about genre. And I think that I think she's absolutely right that it can help and guide and be an asset to a writer, so that a reader, you know, wants to read within the genre, they'll read you because they read within that genre. But at the same time, it can also keep you outside a readership that would love your books. And so I have very mixed feelings about being labeled a crime writer, because I don't think it's inviting to everybody. And not just because it's crime writer, I'm just saying because you're designated in a genre.
Although you said something very interesting on your website when you talked about the element of crime in a story, where you said that, you know, life is a river and crime is the rock that the river has to go around. Some people, some characters swim and some sink. And I thought that was really an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, what I try to create in my books is real people experiencing real adversity. And because I'm a crime writer, that adversity comes in the form of crime. But to be honest, I think if I were writing literary fiction, I would probably find that adversity came in the form of crime. It just wouldn't be called crime fiction. Because, I mean, almost every inciting incident in every novel ever written is based on crime. You know, Bonfire of the Vanities starts with a crime. You know, almost any story you can name, any of the great literature of the last century, is pivotal around a crime. And so to then take one small section of literature and say this is crime fiction, just really, I think, I don't want to use the word alienate, but I think it excludes a wider readership who would be fascinated.
Well, my partner in Speaking of Mysteries, Les Klinger, refers to it as a ghettoization.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's a really good description of it. And I think it's so unfair. You know, when I was a kid, I was allowed to read anything I wanted to read. We would go to the library once a week. But I was also allowed to read anything in our house. And my parents were both big readers. My sister was older than me and was a big reader. And I was allowed to pick any book I wanted to off the shelf and read it. And so, therefore, I read amazing books. I read books I would never have picked off the shelf because, you know, at the time I was reading Stephen King, if I thought to myself, well, I'm only going to read horror, I wouldn't have read the entire house full of books that I did when I was a child. And I think that makes me very wary of categorizing any writer or any genre, because all you're doing really is saying, I don't like science fiction, I won't read poetry, I'm not into crime. And in fact, you know, there's always fantastic writing in every genre.
Right, then if you say, I don't read science fiction, you might miss out on Ray Bradbury or William Gibson.
Precisely.
Or any of the greats.
Precisely. And there are some fantastic science fiction writers out there. I think it's a fascinating genre, and I think probably even more ghettoized than crime fiction is. And yet, oh my goodness, I mean, I spent my childhood just devouring Ray Bradbury and people like that and Arthur C. Clarke. I wouldn't have missed it for the world, and I'm sure it's informed my writing and my imagination no end.
Well, speaking of your writing, what are you working on?
At the moment, I'm writing my next book, obviously. It's called The Beautiful Dead, and it kind of involves art and obsession and a whole bunch of other themes that I won't go into right now. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it.
And hopefully that will be published in the UK this year, next year?
No, that will be published early next year.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate your time, Belinda. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it and how hard it is to describe Rubbernecker except to say that you're absolutely right. If you like to read any sort of crime fiction or you'll just love this book.
I think that's the only description you can give it, Nancy. You'll just love this book. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you.
In the next few weeks, Speaking of Mysteries will be publishing interviews with Hallie Efron, Sarah Weinman, and Matthew Gwynn. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.